Today at Reader's Corner, Mark Adams, author of Turn Right at Machu Picchu, rediscovering the lost city one step at a time.
I knew that I needed a guide if I was going to retrace Hiram Bingham's 1911 route. He had one of the greatest summers in exploration history in 1911, and my plan was to sort of retrace that route. In 1912, Yale and the National Geographic Society send him back to find whatever he can at the site and bring it back for the Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut. The Incas were incredible engineers. They would cut these gigantic stones to a tolerance of less than a millimeter. I don't know how they got the muscle power to get these things put into place, but they're incredibly well constructed.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 2011, the world celebrated the 100th anniversary of explorer Hiram Bingham's remarkable find in the Andean Mountains, the lost Incan citadel of Machu Picchu. Celebrated at the time as a hero, Bingham has lost some of his luster over the past century. Peruvians have questioned how he could have discovered a city that was never lost, and who is the rightful owner of the many antiquities they claim he smuggled out of the country for Yale University's collection. The story of Bingham's amazing discovery in 1911 and the recent controversy surrounding that find are recounted by magazine editor-turned-adventurer Mark Adams in his entertaining book, Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. In retracing Hiram Bingham's footsteps 100 years later, Mr. Adams managed to create not only an accurate historical picture, but a humorous look at the perils and splendor of the Andes. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mark Adams. He is the author of Mr. America, about fitness guru Bernard McFadden, and a writer for many national publications. Mr. Adams joins us by phone for this interview. Mark Adams, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Good to be here, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So, Mark, what's the skinny on this Indiana Jones connection? How did that ever get started, and is there anything to it?
Well, you know, basically, since Indiana Jones, since Raiders of the Lost Ark came out almost 30 or a little over 30 years ago, people have been trying to figure out who was the original inspiration for Indiana Jones. And Hiram Bingham, the fellow who located Machu Picchu, has always been one of the candidates. And I was curious about that. So what I did was I went back and found out that the costume designer for Raiders of the Lost Ark had watched repeatedly a movie called Secret of the Incas, which is a relatively terrible B movie from 1954 starring Charlton Heston. But a lot of it takes place in Cusco and at Machu Picchu. And there are some strange similarities between the plot of that movie and the narrative of Hiram Bingham's most famous book, which is called Lost City of the Incas. And when I started digging around in the archives of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, it turned out that the original draft of Secret of the Incas was basically a ripoff of Bingham's Lost City of the Incas. And somewhere along the line, the plot got watered down. So I'm sure George Lucas and Steven Spielberg have no idea, but Hiram Bingham was probably a bigger inspiration for Indiana Jones than anybody else.
Right. Well, of course, the plots of these movies are very different from Hiram Bingham's life. But when it comes to the two guys, Indiana Jones and Hiram Bingham, did Hiram Bingham look more like the professor than he did the adventurer? I mean, you would expect Hollywood to take off on a Hiram Bingham and turn him into an Indiana Jones.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. The outfit that Bingham wore in 1911, which was his big year of discovery, is pretty similar to the outfit that Indiana Jones wore. You know, he got the fedora, you got the leather jacket, he got everything but the whip. And he was a history professor up at Yale. So, you know, there's a lot of similarities in their character. He wasn't quite the swashbuckler that, you know, Harrison Ford was in the Raiders of the Lost Ark movies, but he was probably more of an egghead.
Well, let's start with the description. Where is Machu Picchu? It's in Peru, but tell me about its main features and its history.
Sure. The reason why Machu Picchu is so alluring is that it's this beautiful white stone city, which is nearly intact. It was built about 600 years ago, which is high on a mountain ridge in the Andes Mountains of Peru, the second highest mountain range in the world. And you can't see it from below. You have to actually climb up a 2,000-foot mountain slope to get to Machu Picchu. And when you do get up there, it sort of reveals itself suddenly, and you look down upon it, and it's absolutely breathtaking. And that's why it was, you know, not lost, but maybe mislaid for centuries because no one could see it from below when they followed the path along the river. You know, some people have guessed that it was a sort of a Camp David for the emperor of the Inca Empire, which was the probably the biggest empire in the Western Hemisphere before the arrival of Christopher Columbus. And recently it's been discovered that some of the buildings actually align with the solstice lines and the equinox lines, which are, you know, the where the sun rises and sets on the longest and shortest days of the year. So there's a lot of stuff at Machu Picchu we don't know yet.
If you're a traveler today, and I'm sure there's going to be people who read your book and will close it and say to their friends, let's go. Let's go there. Now, obviously, we're going to talk about how you did it. And I don't think we want to recommend to anyone that they do it exactly the way you did it, unless right. they want to turn themselves into Hiram Bingham the Adventurer and Mark Adams the Adventurer. But how does the traveler do it who wants to take it a little easier? What happens? How do you get to Machu Picchu? There's a train, isn't there?
There is. I mean, 99% of the people who visit Machu Picchu will fly into Cusco, which is sort of the regional capital. You fly to Lima, which is the national capital, and then to Cusco. It's about an hour. And then you can take a train that's about 3.5 hours. It's an absolutely gorgeous train ride along the Urubamba River. And what's fascinating about Machu Picchu is it's right at the spot where the Andes, which is this, you know, super high, elevated, arid country, crashes into the Amazon basin. So in this 3.5 hour train ride, you go from, you know, a very cold, you know, snow-capped area to essentially the edge of the jungle. So it's a fascinating trip. The other ways to get there are to walk the Inca Trail, which is one of the great treks of the world. That's a 4 or 5 day trip where you can walk from a spot along the Urubamba River through what was actually a sacred pilgrimage that the Incas put together to arrive at Machu Picchu. Or in my case, you can take a whole month and take a really roundabout trip.
Well, there is apparently some kind of a limit on the number of people who can be at Machu Picchu at any one time. You mentioned in your book toward the end when you were referring to a 1999 strike the
yep.
peasant farmers held, that they actually held up the traffic back and forth to Machu Picchu.
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, what happened was about 10, 12 years ago, the United Nations came out and said, you know, look, there are so many people coming to Machu Picchu that if more than 2,500 people come per day, this thing is going to be pulverized into dust in a few generations. For, you know, maybe 10 years, the government didn't really do anything because it's a huge moneymaker for the region. This year, there's a new president after my book came out. Actually, just a couple weeks after it came out, declared that I think they're going to start rationing the numbers of people who can go up to Machu Picchu. Certainly, they're charging now for the right to climb Huayna Picchu, which is that sort of green rhino horn that you'll see in the background of most pictures of Machu Picchu. So I think we're probably going to see some rationing of spots to Machu Picchu, which is going to make it more important than ever to buy your tickets in advance, especially if you want to try something like walking the Inca Trail.
Is elevation a major consideration here? I mean, what's the elevation at Machu Picchu?
It's not that bad. I mean, especially if you live out west, it's 8,200 feet at Machu Picchu and about 6,200 feet at the town below Machu Picchu. So that's, you know, that's right around the borderline where people start having altitude problems. The trick is that you have to fly into Cusco, and Cusco's at almost 12,000 feet. So a lot of people have trouble in Cusco. So you either have to stay in Cusco for 2 or 3 days to acclimatize, or you can hop on the train right away and get down to Machu Picchu at a lower altitude.
Now, the reason I found out about that strike story is that you were yeah. really telling the story of Roxanne. And I guess we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but there is an issue regarding Machu Picchu about who owns it. And
yep.
I found it so fascinating that you tripped across this woman whose grandfather apparently had
yeah.
land surrounding it. Help us understand how Machu Picchu could still be disputed as to its ownership.
Well, the land laws in Peru changed drastically during the 20th century. Essentially, at the beginning of the century, they were a throwback to the what was called the Hacienda era, where after the conquistadors arrived and Francisco Pizarro came and gave out what were called encomiendas or big land holdings to, you know, all of his officers, those were passed down from generation to generation to generation. So what you have was almost like a medieval situation with aristocrats and serfs. So starting in the beginning of the 20th century, the Abril family, Roxana Abril is the woman you referred to, they own most of the land around what is now Machu Picchu. They didn't know Machu Picchu was there until Bingham came out and walked up the top of the slope, 2,000 feet, and he came down and announced to the family, like, you know, you got some incredible ruins up there. So what happened is over time, you know, Bingham also found what's known as the Inca Trail and some other various sites nearby Machu Picchu, and the Abril family sold off chunks over time and came to some sort of arrangement with the Peruvian government in the 1930s and 1940s that they would buy Machu Picchu and take care of it. Well, they took possession of it, but they never worked out the details, and they're still in court. Roxana has been in court for, I think, more than a decade trying to get this settled, and I don't know if they're ever going to find any sort of solution.
It's really hard to believe that the government of Peru is going to let that happen.
It's like I said, the weird thing is there was like a land reform bill in 1969 or 1970 that basically wiped out all the old haciendas. So, you know, there's a legal loophole for them to argue for. But at the same time, Roxana can say, well, you know, we gave you the land before that. So I think the government's going to stretch this out as long as they can.
You mentioned that they didn't know it was there. One of the things I learned reading your book is that there are so many of these cities in ruins that nobody knew was there for a very good reason. Nature took over.
Yeah. You know, this is the cloud forest, you know, like I mentioned, that area very close to the Amazon, but it's still at altitude. And, you know, the cloud forest can grow over a stone city in 2 or 3 years. You know, the trees will get 25 feet high in that time. So there are, you know, probably 4 or 5 sites, not all as nice as Machu Picchu, but comparable to Machu Picchu, you know, former Inca emperor estates and things like that, within walking distance a few days of Machu Picchu. And that's what I did on my trip. I visited several of them en route to Machu Picchu.
You're listening to Mark Adams. He's the author of Turn Right at Machu Picchu, Rediscovering the Lost City One Step at a Time. So let's talk about how you got into this. You're a guy that's sitting in New York and you're writing for these magazines, and you admit early in the book that you're not exactly the great outdoorsman who's in shape to do all this stuff. So now you are married to a Peruvian, and that must have had something to do with this. Obviously, you know a little bit more about Peru than most South American countries, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'd been to Peru several times because my wife has family in Lima, but Lima is a lot like Los Angeles. You know, it's a coastal town with, you know, valet parking and smog and things like that. And I'd never been up into the mountains, which startled me, about an hour outside of Lima. And I was working as an editor at National Geographic Adventure magazine, which is sort of an outdoorsy travel magazine. And Machu Picchu is a celebrity, probably like the British royal family is to Vanity Fair. That's the kind of celebrity Machu Picchu is to National Geographic Adventure. So when two stories came out in 2008 about Hiram Bingham, one of which was that Yale was being sued by the government of Peru to get back some artifacts that Bingham had taken from Machu Picchu in 1912, and the other was that an amateur historian up in Alaska named Paolo Greer had located a map that indicated that maybe Bingham was not the first Westerner to see Machu Picchu, because there was a German named Augusto Burns, who it looks like he may have been up there searching for relics in the 1860s. So these two stories came together, and I was also feeling a little bit of midlife crisis, because I was working at an adventure magazine and had never actually slept in a tent. So I knew it was time to, it was do or die time. I had to get out there.
Well, that's really a great introduction. Now, you mentioned Yale being sued for these artifacts that have been taken from Peru and now reside in some museum at Yale. This is a story that's been told many times on university campuses. Tell us what the issue is at Yale.
Well, this was sort of the golden age of exploration, the years right before World War One. You know, you've got Amundsen and Scott racing for the pole. The North Pole had just been reached. There are guys running around through jungles around the world looking for artifacts. And what they're trying to do is fill all these huge, brand-new museums that these cities and universities have erected. So, you know, in 1911, Bingham gets to Machu Picchu and reports back. And in 1912... Yale and the National Geographic Society send him back to find whatever he can at the site and bring it back for the Peabody Museum in New Haven, Connecticut. So Bingham does that. He comes back in 1912. He's a hyper-organized fellow and essentially strip mines the site. There is really no treasure to be found. I think he found one silver shawl pin, and that was about the most impressive thing he found. A few bronze objects, but mostly pottery, broken pottery, and human remains, because the Incas mummified their dead. So he prepares to bring all this stuff back in 1912, but as so often happened in Peru, there was a revolution, the president was deposed, and Bingham had sort of a handshake agreement to bring all this stuff out of the country. And what the new president said was, okay, I'll cut you a deal. You can take whatever you want out of the country, but as soon as I ask for it back, you've got to send it back. And that was 99 years ago.
And Yale is pretty much sticking to the fact that it's theirs now.
Well, what happened was, as the 100th anniversary approached this past July, Peru really put the pressure on Yale to give the stuff back. They sued them in U.S. federal court. And only at like the 11 and a half hour did Yale come through and say, okay, this is embarrassing to us. We'll give the stuff back. And it's actually in, some of it is back already, and other stuff is en route to Cusco now.
Now, looking at this issue from the standpoint of archaeologists, there's a number of cities, of course, that some of which you visited when you did your trek, mm-hmm. that have really been decimated in some cases by grave robbers. Help us understand what goes on. And many of these folks are local folks. They're not necessarily folks coming from someplace else. And what, they're looking for riches.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same sad story, you know, that goes all the way back to ancient Egypt. These sites were, you know, at the time that they were built to be lived in. And then after that, the mummies who were left behind of the owners were supposed to keep possession of the land forever, because the Inca emperors were thought to be immortal. So they had all sorts of gold objects and things like that at the site. And inevitably, you know, people figured out where these things were buried, and they would, you know, knock down these gorgeous white stone buildings to find whatever they could that was buried in the ground. Whatever it was at Machu Picchu before Hiram Bingham got there had been stolen, you know, decades, if not centuries, before he ever got there. So the sad part about this is that, you know, we've lost a lot of these objects, but also that a lot of these buildings have been destroyed in the process of what's called huaqueando, or grave robbing. In fact, when Bingham first got to Peru in 1909, he was taken to another site called Choqquequirau, and when he got up there, they were blasting apart the ruins with dynamite, looking for what was called the buried treasure of the Incas.
And how old is Machu Picchu?
Machu Picchu, we think it was built in the 1450s or 1460s. Mm-hmm.
And you talk in your book, and I think there's some photos in the middle of your book, about the stone construction and the fact that they didn't use mortar. Does that have anything to do with the reason why it's so well preserved, that what moisture couldn't get in? Or, I mean, why is it that so many hundreds of years later you should find this thing in such great shape?
Well, it's because the Incas were just incredible engineers. You know, they would cut these gigantic stones, some of which are the size of like a VW bus, you know, to a tolerance of you know, less than a millimeter. And, you know, I don't know how they got the muscle power to get these things put into place, but they're incredibly well constructed, especially when you think that Machu Picchu was built across two earthquake fault lines. So, you know, Cusco has been leveled twice since recorded history began in the last 500 years, and all the buildings had fallen down that the Spaniards built, but the original Inca walls are still standing. The same thing is true at Machu Picchu, and that's because this Inca building style, what's called the imperial style, the stones are not put together with mortar, and that allows them, they allow it dancing. The stones will sort of bounce around and then fall back into place, and that's why Machu Picchu looks today pretty much the same way as it did probably 500, 600 years ago.
Wouldn't that take some mathematical calculation and engineering expertise? Has anybody uncovered just how they went about this?
Well, we don't know. One fascinating thing about the Incas is, and there's lots of evidence in the 16th century Spanish chronicles about this, they kept a thing called quipu, which were these long knotted cords, and sometimes they were dyed different colors. The knots had different colors. And originally they were thought to be just kind of like abacuses because the Incas were incredibly good accountants. There are cases where Inca accountants would go into court against Spanish accountants, and they would always demolish them because they always had the best facts and figures. So there may be evidence in the few remaining quipu that we know of. There are, I think, less than 100 of these things, certainly less than 1,000, that will tell us some of the Inca building techniques. Unfortunately, the Spaniards during the Inquisition said that these were pagan idols and ordered them to be burned, so there are very few of them left. And there's actually a team at Harvard right now who are working on decoding these things. So there may be some secrets about the engineering skills that we'll find in these quipu.
Today I'm talking with Mark Adams, author of Turn Right at Machu Picchu. Tell us a little bit about your own journey. You worked with a crew of mule handlers. You had this really interesting character from Australia who I guess you've become good friends with over the years. Tell us about how that all happened.
Well, I knew that I needed a guide if I was going to retrace Hiram Bingham's 1911 route. And I should say Hiram Bingham's 1911 trip, he was not looking for Machu Picchu. He was looking for what was known as the Lost City of the Incas, which turned out to be a town down in the jungle. And on that 1911 trip, he found the city down in the jungle, which is known as Vilcabamba. He found another city called Vitcos, which is another beautiful imperial city in the mountains. And then he also found Machu Picchu. So he had, you know, one of the greatest summers in exploration history in 1911. And my plan was to sort of retrace that route. And I knew that I had to get a guide. And I found this guy, John Levers, who's an Australian expatriate and like one of the last great gentleman explorers in existence. He spends all of his time in Cusco essentially wandering around in the mountains looking for undiscovered pre-Columbian ruins, which he takes photographs and video of because they're disappearing so fast. And John put together a team of mule tenders. We had three mule tenders and a cook because this was basically going to take a month. And I had no idea going into this how difficult it was going to be, you know, in terms of walking through these mountains. You know, I'd done some hiking in the Rockies and such, but, you know, this is climbing up and down 1 mile-high ridge after another, and it is just absolutely exhausting. It's breathtakingly beautiful, but it's really hard work.
And these mule handlers were just local folks who hired on?
These were guys who lived, you know, most of the time they work as farmers, but they also guide trips in their spare time. You know, these are guys whose first language is Quechua, which is the Indian language of the Andes, and then they speak Spanish as well, certainly no English. And, you know, I mean, these are some tough dudes. My mule tenders were in their, you know, probably their 40s or 50s and their 70s, and these guys were running up, you know, 60-degree slopes with bags on their back. I mean, and, of course, part of the reason why they had energy is because they chew coca leaves all day.
I was going to ask you about that. tell us about those coca leaves.
Well, on our first day out of town when we left Cusco, it was Sunday morning. It was about 8 o'clock, and we pulled off at this farmer's market type area. And we had a shopping list. We got all these things. And then our cook, Justo, said to me, he's like, well, we got to get the coca. And I was like, what? He's like, we need coca leaves for the trip. We need enough coca for the whole trip. And we go to the coca lady, and she's got mountains of coca leaves, and basically like a small hefty bag full of coca leaves is what we purchased. I looked it up on the DEA website when I got back, and it turns out that I was committing what was the equivalent of a Class A felony in the U.S., but there was just a Sunday shopping trip to the market.
These are you do just chew the leaves?
Yeah, I mean, you just the root product of cocaine, but you have to distill it so much. I usually compare the relationship to taking a Sudafed tablet versus smoking crystal meth. You know, it's so many thousands of times reduced by the time it gets into cocaine form that, you know, the effect is it relieves you know, altitude headache. They call it soroche. And it also, it gives you a mild buzz, but it's like taking a nap and then drinking a cup of tea. That's about as exciting as it gets.
Did you really have to get in shape to do this?
You know, I was in okay shape. I mean, John told me, John Lieber, before we did the trip, he's like, you know, Mark, you got to, you know, get your back into shape because you're going to be carrying a, you know, a day pack and, you know, work on your legs a little bit. And I, you know, I worked out for about 6 weeks and, you know, I was in okay shape. But that second day, we left camp and we had to walk up a mile-high slope that was, I mean, almost vertical. It was, you know, had switchbacks. It was, it cut back and forth. But I have never done anything that hard in my entire life. I've run a couple marathons, and it's not even close. I thought I was going to die. If we weren't in the middle of nowhere, I'm sure I would have just stopped and, you know, laid down and cried. But I knew that if we didn't get to the top, I was going to be stuck there for the rest of my
life. Well, this puts it all in perspective, because in your book, I did not get the impression you ran a couple of marathons. I must have missed that. So if you've run a couple of marathons and then you still have problems down there, that's a real problem for most people who are going to want to visit Machu Picchu.
Well, that's a trip to Choqquequirau. That's a different story. Machu Picchu, the trail is, you know, it's tough, but it's not that hard.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go into it blind. We saw some people on the trail, you know, we saw a group of fat French guys who obviously thought they were out on a boondoggle, and these guys were dying. You can't just go from completely sedentary to walking the Inca Trail. It's, you know, it'll knock you on your butt. You see a lot of porters. Porters are the Peruvian guys who have to carry everything on the Inca Trail, you know, essentially carrying these people up the mountainside as the sun starts to go down. Otherwise, they'd have to leave them behind.
Now, the Incas placed Machu Picchu at a very specific site regarding the winter and summer solstice. Is that correct?
Yep. There's a guy named Johann Reinhard, who's a National Geographic explorer in residence, and he's pretty well known. About 20 years ago, he found an Inca mummy on top of a mountain in Peru at about 20,000 feet. What had happened is a volcano nearby had erupted and melted away some snow, and he found an intact mummy of a girl, and it was buried with gold and silver relics and things like that. Another thing that he's done is come up with what's called the sacred center theory, which is that, you know, Machu Picchu is not just the Camp David of the Inca Emperor. It was built so that there's a temple at Machu Picchu called the Torreon that has a window that faces east, and I was there on the day of the June solstice, and the sun rises over a peak directly to the east and sort of hovers over the peak like a halo around Jesus's head in a Renaissance painting.
Sure.
And then it gets a little bit higher, and it shoots a beam of light through this window that forms a rectangle on a circular rock inside the Torreon temple, which almost looks like a trophy base where the trophy's been cracked off. And the question is, you know, what was there originally? What sort of, you know, spectacular thing was there that we're missing now? One theory is that the emperor who built Machu Picchu, named Pachacutec, who's sort of like the Alexander the Great of the Incas, originally had a golden statue of himself there, but that it was taken down and melted when the Spaniards arrived in 1532.
Well, what a great story. Whether our listeners we'll ever get to Machu Picchu is up to them. But even if they don't, if they want to take a ride, all they need to do is pick up your book. And it's called Turn Right at Machu Picchu. And the author is Mark Adams. Mark, it's been great having you on the show. Appreciate what you've done here. And any plans for the future? Is this now going to be, there's a lot of countries down there in South America. You could probably find something.
Well, the next book, I'm going in search of Atlantis.
Aha.
Yeah, so that might be a little bit more difficult, but we'll see.
Great. Well, I just did a little bit of that on a Disney cruise, but I think that's a different kind of Atlantis.
Yeah, it's a different story.
Anyway, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mark Adams. Next week, Mark Lynch, author of The Arab Uprising, The Unfinished Revolution of the Middle East. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.